losing property and liberty. We have all seen horror movies in which someone's having a nightmare, and when he wakes up, he discovers that waking reality is simply an extension of his nightmare. That's the reality of much American life today, as our worst fears about threats to life, liberty, and property have become everyday news stories. This is a world where mothers are encouraged to kill their babies, and where the right to defend life, liberty, and property is being constantly eroded in the name of public safety or the common good. Even our own homes do not really belong to us. Mortgage companies, taxing authorities, and environmental protection agencies all have claims that supersede those of the property owners. And at the most fundamental level, our rights to our property may be taken away at any time if powerful political and commercial interests have a reason to seize our home or our business. Let's talk about some nightmares. Suppose you're living in a nice rundown Polish neighborhood in your family home, where you're informed that the city has cut a deal with General Motors to build a plant. And in the interest of economic progress, you and your neighbors will have to give up your entire world. This is the Poletown case in Detroit. Suppose you've inherited a little money and bought a piece of rental property as an investment. For 10 years, you've invested time and sweat equity and made a little money, only to learn that the city is going to turn the area over to a private developer so that he can make not a little money, but big money. This is in Norwood, Ohio. Suppose you're living in a black working class neighborhood in Riviera Beach, Florida. It's not paradise, but a better place to live than you could find elsewhere. What is your reaction when you realize that local officials have commissioned a group of experts to declare your neighborhood a blight? That's the first step towards seizing the place and turning it over to developers who will create an upscale community for condo buyers. Finally, suppose that you have lovingly restored a little house overlooking the river in New London, Connecticut, and made it a family home. When a Pfizer plant is built nearby, the city decides to capitalize and grant the power of eminent domain to a private corporation, giving it the power to seize your whole neighborhood and create an upscale development. This is the Kelo case. Horror stories like these have been going on for decades, but they attracted attention only in the local press or from think tanks that specialize in property rights. By the way, most of those think tanks have a very imperfect understanding both of the philosophy and the legal history of the question. The dirty business of property confiscation received the full light of day when over a decade ago the Supreme Court decided the last case that I mentioned, Kelo versus New London, Connecticut. They decided that local governments did have the right to rob Peter to pay Paul so long as Paul was going to help economic progress. In her memorable dissent, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor wrote, and I quote, "Any property may now be taken for the benefit of another private party, but the fallout from this decision will not be random. The beneficiaries are likely to be those citizens with disproportionate influence and power in the political process, large corporations, and development firms," end quote. Justice O'Connor's dissent is doubly memorable. First, because it seems on the surface to be that rare thing, a ringing defense of property rights. But second, because no one in our time has done so much to expand the power of eminent domain as Sandra Day O'Connor. More on that later. Most Americans know very little of our nation's history. The public schools and universities see to that. And what little they think they know is the usual leftist propaganda about our national history of racism, sexism, capitalist oppression, whatever the latest perversity is they wish to celebrate. Patriotic Americans, on the other hand, feel there's something wrong with this account, and there's something wrong with a country that doesn't defend property. Didn't Americans fight and win a revolution precisely because they were tired of a faraway and arbitrary government that taxed them without their consent and interfered in their private business? In fact, Americans of the 1760s and 1770s were growing increasingly angry with the British government. Although there were many points at issue, especially in Massachusetts, where the royal government tried to control the press and prevent the people from lodging protests either in public meetings or in written documents, but the main complaints had to do with tax policies and property rights. It's not that the king and parliament were not justified in taxing the colonies. On the contrary, the cost of supporting an army and navy to defend the colonists from their enemies, both their domestic enemies, namely the Native Americans, and foreign enemies, the French and the Spanish, this was considerable. What annoyed the colonists was not so much the fact that they were taxed as how they were taxed and how the money was collected and how the laws were enforced. To make a long and complex story very short, the British government imposed a series of taxes, stamps on legal documents such as wills and contracts, tariffs on tea, molasses, and cider. When the wily New Englanders attempted to evade these taxes, and Scottish and English merchants back home were also accomplished smugglers, by the way, as were the Americans, the revenue agents could use general writs of assistance. These are something like our own John Doe warrants. And backed by uniformed soldiers armed with muskets and bayonets, these revenue agents could invade anyone's warehouse, shop, or even home if it contained contraband, because many shops were, after all, in the same building as the home. During the crisis that followed the passage of the Stamp Act, James Otis of Massachusetts made a stirring defense of colonial rights that John Adams later declared to be the beginning of the American Revolution. It was Otis who coined the term no taxation without representation, though interestingly my former congressman Don Manzullo claimed on the floor of Congress that it was actually said by Thomas Jefferson. This is what we get for congressmen today. But many English statesmen also opposed the act. It was not just Americans. William Pitt made a passionate speech in Parliament stating the historic legal truth that, quote, the poorest man may in his cottage bid defiance to all the forces of the crown. It may be frail, its roof may shake, the wind may blow through it, the storms may enter, the rain may enter, but the King of England cannot enter. All his forces dare not cross the threshold of the ruined tenement, end quote. There's a reason why William Pitt, by the way, has a statue in Charleston, South Carolina. Grateful merchants called for it to be erected as a tribute to the man who had defended them from unjust taxation. Parliament eventually suspended all the odious taxes except the tariff on tea, which they kept for mostly symbolic purposes to show that London had the right to tax the colonies whenever and however the government liked. A big mistake this was that would cost George III his American colonies. When the colonists put up further resistance, the government responded with the so-called coercive acts or the abominable acts. Parliament closed the port of Boston and fundamentally changed the Massachusetts charter and legal system, possibly forcing colonists accused of evading taxes to be tried in other colonies or even in far-off England, and transferring jurisdiction in cases where a soldier had killed a civilian. A soldier could not expect to get a sympathetic jury. Although, by the way, after the so-called Boston Massacre, when British troops fired on hoodlums who assaulted them with rocks and snowballs, John Adams actually defended them in court and got them off. George Washington, for this reason, called it the Murder Act. An unrelated measure that also angered the colonists was the Quebec Act, that gave freedom of religion to Catholics in the Northwest Territory of America that was regarded as part of Quebec. This seems harmless enough, but New England Puritans suspected that the Crown was going to try to establish the Church of England throughout the colonies. And by establish, I mean that you would have to pay taxes for its support. And recognizing the Catholic Church was the first step toward interfering with colonial religious establishments. The coercive acts only stiffened resistance, and the rest, as they say, is history. When the revolution was won with indispensable help from the French army and navy, the 13 states governed themselves under a loose confederation. But when it was proposed to strengthen the central government by adopting a stronger constitution, many solid patriots balked and demanded a Bill of Rights that guaranteed freedom of religion. They remembered, after all, the Quebec Acts, and their old political rights to assemble and petition the government. They were also deeply troubled by questions of taxation, due process, and private property, hence the prohibition on search and seizure inspired by the misuse of general writs. There was also the due process clauses that became the Fifth Amendment. Embedded in the Fifth Amendment is a clause that seems out of place. After saying no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, the amendment adds, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Well, what public use did they have in mind? The Constitution itself tells us that Congress shall have the power to establish post offices and post roads. Under most circumstances, the property for roads and post offices would have to be taken from private landowners, and such takings had been common in all the colonies, which acquired land also for fortifications, harbor facilities, roads, and even water mills. Hardly anyone ever objected. There seemed to be an unlimited supply of land, and the value of land was actually increased if it was protected from Indian attacks or had access to roads and water mills. Then why worry about just compensation? In the southern states, in fact, property was typically seized without compensation and there were no complaints. Why not? No legal scholar has offered an entirely satisfactory explanation, but we do have some idea of what was on the minds of the people who were calling for such an amendment. In the first place, the construction of a federal city would require a good deal of land in a settled area. What would happen if a crime were committed in such a territory? Would a state retain its jurisdiction, or could felons take refuge on the national property, sort of like Butch Cassidy and the Wild Bunch? They were also worried about British and Tory landowners who were trying to enforce their claims over land that had been confiscated at the beginning of the Revolution. The states were routinely rejecting these appeals. But might not a national government try to curry favor with Britain by acknowledging these claims or by confiscating disputed property and turning over the sale price to the legitimate British owners? This was actually argued in the Virginia Ratifying Convention, where some delegates were worried about the claims of the Fairfax family to the northern neck of Virginia. John Marshall, the future Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and the father of judicial activism, he argued it was impossible, but it would not be long before Marshall became the Fairfax's legal representative in America. Well, this is something to think about, by the way, when we try to evaluate the career of John Marshall. John Marshall, shill for the British. There was another older concern that goes back through English history. Let's just listen to two demands from the state of New York during the ratifying debates. The first addressed the question of jurisdiction on federal property. Quote, that the right of exclusive legislation with respect to such places as may be purchased for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings shall not authorize the Congress to make any laws to prevent the laws of the states from extending to all such places in civil and criminal matters. This shows the eagerness of New Yorkers to preserve states' rights. However, this specific demand is preceded by a broader claim. And again, I quote, that no person ought to be taken, imprisoned, or dissized of his freehold, or exiled, or deprived of his privileges, franchises, life, liberty, or property, but by due process of law. This is followed by a list of things related: due process, habeas corpus, excessive bail, cruel or unusual punishment, trial by jury, search and seizures. Now, this is exactly the combination of rights bundled together shortly afterwards in the Fifth Amendment drafted by James Madison. But note the key phrase, "decised of his freehold," that is, deprived of property to which he has exclusive rights. The notion of a freehold, by the way, is now a concept that is alien to America. We almost have no freeholds because our land is always subject to some form of limitation or confiscation by government when it has a good purpose. This ancient language of freehold and decising goes back to Magna Carta, which the English barons extorted out of Bad King John. No freeman shall be taken or imprisoned or decised or exiled or in any way destroyed, nor will we go upon him, nor send upon him, except by the lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land. In effect, only Parliament, which represented the peers and the commons, could seize property, not the king, and certainly not a mere court. The New Yorkers may well have learned this lesson from reading Blackstone's famous commentaries on the common law, published only three decades earlier. Blackstone was a great defender of property rights, and I quote, "So great is the regard of the law for private property that it will not authorize the least violation of it. No, not even for the general good of the whole community. If a new road, for instance, were to be made through the grounds of a private person, it might perhaps be extensively beneficial to the public. But the law permits no man or set of men to do this without the consent of the owner of the land. In vain may it be urged that the good of the individual ought to yield to that of the community, for it would be dangerous to allow any private man, or even any public tribunal, to be the judge of this common good, and to decide whether it be expedient or no." Property rights were, in fact, very secure in England in the 18th century. The Parliament might acquire land for a vital national purpose, but such actions were as rare and justifiable as the small number of divorces granted by the House of Lords. Nonetheless, Blackstone's stirring defense of property rights, so frequently cited, is a little misleading. While it is true that Blackstone believed in a natural right to property, quote, "which consists in the free use, enjoyment, and disposal of all his acquisitions without any control or diminution save only by the laws of the land," the laws of the land in question included the power of eminent domain, as Blackstone acknowledges, but he argues that it is legitimate if exercised by the legislature. Blackstone's distinction between the legislature and the executive, while it goes back to Magna Carta, was compatible with the 18th century view that a state was based on a social contract, according to which men had surrendered certain rights in order to establish a beneficial civil order. The people collectively exercised such rights through a representative legislature. Thus, to be a British subject or a citizen of New York, one had to be a party to this social contract. As members of society, we share a common burden, which might include loss of part or all of our property. On this principle, a duly elected legislature could legitimately confiscate property for public good, and a property owner would only have grounds for complaint if he was forced to shoulder a disproportionate share of the burden. Eminent domain has also been justified as an essential attribute of sovereignty that cannot be alienated by a state, even by a statutory law. A state, for example, in America, might confiscate a strip of land for a railroad and close off roads that would cross the tracks. But any agreement not to infringe further upon property owners or not to reopen a road could not be enforced without denying the sovereignty that belongs to the state of Illinois or Ohio or South Carolina. And that's impossible. In Cole versus the United States of 1875, this is a landmark case authorizing the federal government's use of eminent domain within the states, that is to confiscate property without even the consent of the state government. The Supreme Court ruled that the power of eminent domain was vital to the very existence of any government and did not rest on any theory that the state is the ultimate owner of all property. This is a little tricky here. In Cole, and in similar subsequent decisions, American judges have tried to invent a democratic theory for eminent domain in order to distance American law from the older, more feudal theories like Hugo Grotius, the Dutch jurist and political theorist, who introduced the term dominium eminens into standard legal and political discourse. In The Laws of War and Peace, Grotius tried to coat the naked power of the state with a philosophical veneer of eminent domain theory. "There are two kinds of right," argued Grotius. "The one private, established for the advantage of each individual," I'm quoting now, "the other superior, as involving the claims which the state has upon individuals and their property for the public good. Thus, the regal authority is above that of a father and master, and the sovereign has a greater right over the property of his subjects, where the public good is concerned, than the owners themselves have. And when the exigencies of the state require a supply, that is, require money or property, every man is more obliged to contribute towards it than to satisfy his creditors. By eminent domain theory, then, this is the old-fashioned theory, then state governments exercise, that is, the governments of sovereign states, exercise a regal authority over all the subject's property, wherever the sovereign decides that the public good is concerned. It does not require a political genius to realize that in each and every case, public good means the sovereign's good. It means the good of the rulers, whether the rulers are a single king or an aristocracy, the Congress of the United States, or the politicians and big businessmen who own the Congress. It hardly matters whether sovereignty is exercised by a despotic king in the 18th century or by a ward-heeling city councilman in Milwaukee or Chicago. Unlike the bogus democratic theory that somehow it's the people's right to do what they want and that this is distinctive and free, Grotius' feudal theory is worthy of respect. As one libertarian writer has argued, the power of eminent domain seems to fit better with a feudal conception of property. But it hardly matters which of several theories is used to justify eminent domain, since the ugly reality is that all the theories used make government effectively the ultimate owner of property. At least the older feudal theory does not deprive the dispossessed property owner of the right to complain. But you can't complain at a democracy because you're part of the sovereign ruling class. It seems strange that in a modern world that hates all things medieval, we should still be subject to a feudal concept of property, but the reason is not far to seek. The Renaissance princes who built great nation-states were quick to see the advantages of a theory of property that gave them ultimate authority over every acre of land in their kingdoms. Think about this. When William the Conqueror came to England within a decade or so, the land tenure, about 93% of the land property in England, changed hands, and ultimately the king was felt to be the sole possessor of the property, and he simply gave it to you, loaned it to you on condition of good behavior. And this is the feudal theory of property in general, that you get land in return for your promise of military service. So ultimately, unless you're dealing with a true freehold or what is called allodial property, if you're not dealing with that, and there's no such thing in America, then the property ultimately belongs to the government. Just as Renaissance princes saw the advantage of such a theory of property, so too politicians of every type, including socialist revolutionaries who don't believe in property. The leftist revolutionaries who seized control of Mexico and Russia during World War I, both of them passed fundamental laws declaring that all property belongs ultimately to the people and therefore to the government. The resulting confiscations were catastrophic. In America, at least, the property grabbers were under some constraint by the courts, and perhaps more importantly, from public opinion. They could only take property from a private owner if it was for public use. In recent decades, however, the term public use, which used to have a clear meaning, has given way to phrases like public purpose, meaning public benefit or the common good. The Polltown case I mentioned at the beginning was an important example from the early 1980s. Although the Michigan Supreme Court eventually reversed itself in 2004, it was too late to save a neighborhood that had been bulldozed over 20 years early. A more significant case is the 1984 Supreme Court ruling in Hawaii, Housing Authority versus Midkiff. The justices ruled unanimously that the state of Hawaii could confiscate property from large landowners to break them up and sell them to private individuals. Writing for the court, Sandra Day O'Connor declared that the Fifth Amendment's use of the phrase public use did not restrict a state or local agency. And she added, the public use requirement is, I'm quoting, coterminous with the scope of a sovereign's police power. So to the extent that a sovereign government or a state government has police power to arrest citizens to commit crimes, it can also confiscate his property. Now, this is legal and logical nonsense. The Fifth Amendment was designed to limit takings, not to expand the police power. But there's something worse. In O'Connor's decision, the power of eminent domain as part of the police power that the states need to protect the citizens can be used whenever a government deems it necessary. Of course, she's right about the Bill of Rights in the early Republic, which were not supposed to dictate terms to the states, but the Bill of Rights is now a dead letter, and it seems all they ever do is dictate terms to states and local communities. Obviously, these decisions will not go unchallenged, and the Kelo case has inspired a majority of state legislatures to take up legislation to limit the power of eminent domain to public use. There are several reasons why these efforts, well-intentioned as they are doomed to fail. First of all, in the Hawaii case, the Supreme Court has already ruled that the term public use can include the transfer of property to private citizens. Secondly, many of the legislatures are demagoguing this issue. In South Carolina, they've made it very clear that public use includes economic development. Thirdly, local governments are champing at the bit to expand eminent domain powers because it's the easiest way they have found to raise revenue without raising taxes. If politicians tell you they're going to fix this problem, don't believe them. They're lying because they always lie. And fourthly, it may not matter what bills are passed. If you can believe the federal courts, it is now a settled rule of law that the states cannot sign away any particle of their power of eminent domain. Here is the judgment of the premier source on eminent domain law. Quote, the power of eminent domain is inalienable, and being an essential attribute of sovereignty cannot be even partially bargained away. In other words, your property can be alienated, but what we can't alienate is the state's ability to take your property away. It seems clear from what I have sketched out that the courts and the legislatures have adopted a revolutionary conception of property. Property no longer belongs ultimately to the owner, subject to the sensible and practical condition that for a genuine public emergency like flood control or national defense, he may have to sell it to the state. Today, on the contrary, our concept is more like that of revolutionary Mexico or the USSR. The state is the ultimate source of property rights. And while the state may be content to leave us undisturbed in possessing our home or business, that is only because the state or some corrupt city councilman has not yet figured out a use for them. No one is challenging this conception, certainly not liberal Democrats. But what's very sad, neither the Republican Party nor conservative movement think tanks are willing to go to the root of the issue. Property, along with life and liberty, is one of the three fundamental rights of the Anglo-American political tradition. None of them is being protected by the federal courts, which make their decisions not according to the Constitution, but according to liberal fashion. Consider this. The same Supreme Court that strikes down state restrictions on abortions is now upholding the right of a state to seize your property for private use. The conservative movement began as a healthy response to the threat of socialism, the threat against our liberty and the threat to our prosperity, our property, and our income. Today, however, neither liberals nor conservatives show any interest in defending the limited constitutional government for which the American Revolution was fought. If we wish to preserve any bit of what is left of our republican liberty and to keep our property, then conservative judicial activists will have to turn away from ideas and policies that have led us to elevate the presidency and the federal courts above the Constitution and to adopt what Paul Craig Roberts has called the Führer principle, that is, the leader is always right. And we are going to have to start educating ourselves and our friends and our children on the true principles of the American Constitution and not the phony Constitution that has been invented by unelected judges.